This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The vote on the GOP Senate health care bill has been delayed. Why the wait? We get to that now on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. It's Wednesday, hump day. We're halfway through the week. And we're here to get you up to date with all the news right here on Tactics. I'm your humble host, Caleb Cockwood. As always, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you this morning. And before we do get into our top story today, did want to do just a quick housekeeping thing. Just met Justice Moore for the first time. Seems like a really nice guy, was very cordial to me. We've already got his, I've been in contact for the past 2 weeks with his campaign manager. We're scheduling, trying to work it out with, because of course my show's a little bit later in the day, and so Justice being a very busy guy, it's a little harder to coordinate his schedule with me because I'm on later. But we've been in contact with him, so we are going to have him on. I've gotten in touch with Mo Brooks' people. Not sure about that one yet, but we definitely have Justice Moore, Luther Strange, and it looks like we're going to get Dr. Brinson on as well. Hopefully we'll be able to get in touch with Mo Brooks as well. So we're going to try to get all the candidates on that we can, and we will get that sooner rather than later, hopefully. But I did want to go ahead and get into our top story today. The healthcare vote has been delayed. Now, this is big news. It was honestly kind of a surprise. It looked like they were going to go ahead and run through with it. This is not really a surprise, to be perfectly honest. I said that it was a surprise. I meant to say that it's not all that surprising because it was McConnell certainly wanted it to go through. It may have been a surprise to him. But the reason that it's not really unexpected is that we had the release date set to this week so it could pass right before the 4th of July. So essentially what they were trying to do is, and unfortunately we see Congress do this all too often, that the plan is to essentially throw out a bill and then get it passed quickly before everybody can read everything in it. And then right after they pass it, we go straight to some kind of major holiday break. So the senators aren't there talking about it, and then, or congressmen, it could have been a bill that passed in the House. Of course, this time it's the Senate. And then you have, that lag time where everybody just kind of forgets about it. They're not really watching the news, not paying attention because they're busy going on vacation, seeing family, that kind of thing. And so by the time you come back from that long weekend, everybody's kind of forgotten about it because, unfortunately, the congressmen understand that the vast majority of the American people are fickle. So they use that to their advantage to try to minimize the backlash that they get from those things. That seems to be that was Mitch McConnell's plan. Now, probably the reason that he wound up backing out is that just last night, three more Republican senators vowed a no vote, which brings the total up to 9. Remember, he can only lose 2 because all the Democrats have vowed to oppose it, and there's only 52 Republican senators. So at the very best, he would have to get up to 50 and then get Mike Pence to break the tie, which, that being said, honestly, I would be surprised if Mike Pence voted for this thing based on his record. He may do it just because that would be what Trump would want. I'm not really sure. I don't know if they even talked to Mike Pence because they never got to that stage because, like I said, 9 Republican senators now are saying that there's a no vote. And the interesting thing about it is you've got a mix of this because I would consider 4 of those 9 very conservative senators. And their problem with this bill is that it isn't nearly conservative enough. It's not enough of a repeal of Obamacare. Unfortunately, the other 5 are essentially saying it's not Obamacare enough for them. They're upset with the cuts to Medicaid. They're upset to the cuts to some of the other regulations. And so, for example, the individual mandate being gone. So really, interestingly enough, you've got senators opposing it, but for completely different reasons. Some of them believe that it's not conservative enough. The others think that it's too conservative. So it what does this mean for us? Well, it gives us more time for examination and also possibly amendments. So now we have what it looks like maybe at least a couple of weeks, possibly more, to really go through this thing. Now, this is a huge bill. This is over 140 pages. It is not nearly as big as the Obamacare plan initially was, which was about 2,000. So it's not that bad, but still, there's a lot to go through, a lot of legalese, some minuscule things that we might have missed. And so this gives us more time for examination into what's actually in this bill. It also gives other Republican senators time for amendments, which, if you're wanting this thing to get passed, is a very good thing, because it doesn't look like without any amendments, the nine senators that said they would vote no said they would vote no as it is written now. Even I would consider the most conservative senator we have, Mike Lee of Utah, has said, well, if it's amended properly, then I would consider voting for it. But right now, that's a no-go. So there's a lot of moving parts to this story, a lot of technicalities that we've got to look into. So McConnell understands that. He knows that. And I think that's probably why he decided to put off the vote for right now. He knew that if it got voted on now, it would just be struck down. So there is one thing that is disturbing about this whole thing, because before this announcement was made, one of the claims McConnell made, and I assume that he's sticking to this story, even though the vote has been delayed, McConnell and other people on the right that are the power players in the Senate had been lying to you about the parliamentarian. Because essentially what they said was, and granted, the parliamentarian does have some say in this because it's a reconciliation bill. It's not a straight up bill. Reconciliation means they would be able to pass it with 50 as opposed to 60, because it's a process by which they essentially undo bad bills that were passed previously through the taking away of funding. It's more complicated than that, but that's the easy explanation. So McConnell and a lot of others were saying that the parliamentarian essentially stated that they could not actually do a repeal, but the Senate parliamentarian has since come out and said, yeah, this could go a lot further, actually. He said that we got that report from Mike Lee the other day saying that, yeah, this bill could go much further than it actually does, even though it is reconciliation. And furthermore, when McConnell said that, and this is an interesting tidbit of information, when he said that the parliamentarian had told him that repeal was not possible, the parliamentarian had not yet been contacted. So Mitch McConnell straight up lied to the American people about that. I guess we shouldn't be surprised. McConnell does kind of have a track record of doing that, but my point in all of that is McConnell was determined to get this thing through, even if it took him lying to the American people. Shameless. And this is where this all boils down. Even they know their bill sucks. They know it. McConnell knows it. That's why he tried to keep it under wraps until just a week before it passed. That's why he tried to pass it right before the July 4th weekend. That's why he tried to say, oh, we can't do anything about it. The parliamentarian is saying we can't pass this through reconciliation if it's a full repeal. They know their bill sucks. They're ashamed of it, which is why they're trying to pass it in the dead of night with as little problems as possible. If they were proud of their bill, they would want to show it off. They would want it to be in the spotlight. They would want people to take a look at it. But they don't, so they're trying to sneak it in the back door like a teenager that showed up to curfew late. Look at Mo Brooks, our own Mo Brooks in the House. His Obamacare repeal was one sentence long, and he did show it off, made the media rounds. Now, it didn't go anywhere in the House, but it essentially just said, as of such and such date, everything that was passed under the Affordable Care Act is hereinto repealed. I don't know why we didn't pass that one. But he was proud of that and made the news rounds, did press releases. McConnell was trying to sneak this thing in the back door, and it did not work. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to give your opinions. We'll be back.
Oh, yeah. This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The name of the Lord, says the scripture, is a strong tower. Thither the righteous flee and are safe. Let us secure his favor, and he will lead us through the journey of this life and, at length, receive us to a better. Samuel Adams.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. This has been debated for essentially 2 weeks in the national news, and they've gotten a lot of different people to comment on it. CNN is, of course, no exception to this. They had this one really interesting interview with a guy named Jonathan Gruber. Now, for those of you who don't remember exactly who Jonathan Gruber is, Gruber is the guy who was the architect of Obamacare. And the thing about Gruber is that he was the same guy you may remember from the news, because most people won't remember his name, but they may remember what he said. Gruber was the one who said that Obamacare was a Trojan horse. So you may remember that clip where he was saying a lot of people are claiming that Obamacare is a Trojan horse, that it's really just designed to collapse and then pave the way for single-payer health care, and they're right. So Gruber is the guy that essentially admitted that Obamacare was just a smokescreen to move us closer towards single-payer health care. This guy was... He's not called the architect of Obamacare for no reason. Even the liberal side calls him that. So intimately involved in creating and crafting Obamacare. He had an interview on CNN the other day, which was very interesting and telling. So let's go ahead and listen to that. Clip one, Jonathan Gruber on CNN.
Just compared to the House version, does this bill have more heart, as the president would say, Jonathan?
You know, I'm torn this morning. On the one hand, this is no longer an Obamacare repeal bill. That's good. On the other hand, this is just a giant cut in Medicaid. That's what this bill now amounts to.
Huh.
And that's bad. Because delaying... Look, we have a very long future ahead of us. If you delay for 3 years the Medicaid cuts, you have the convenient feature, which Doug knows well, which is CBO scores over a 10-year period. So by delaying it for 3 years, you reduce the headline number of how many people lose health insurance. But over the long run, it actually cuts Medicaid more. And why? It doesn't reduce the deficit, barely at all, at least according to previous estimates. We won't know for sure till next week. The only thing it does is finance a giant tax cut for the rich. So really, the Obamacare repeal has become a smokescreen. This is just a Medicaid cut to finance tax cuts for the rich.
So I want to break that into parts. And Doug, I'm going to get your response to both sides of that. But first, Jonathan, when you say it's no longer an Obamacare repeal, specifically on that part, what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is, if you look at what was criticized Obamacare, it was subsidies, it was regulations, it was other things. This law wouldn't really change those, at least according to the leaked drafts we're seeing. It really changed it very much. Now, the changes it would make are bad, and I'm opposed to them, but they're not nearly as radical as the House changes. So really what they're doing is weakening the Obamacare repeal elements, which I like in some sense, but instead they're just doing a much more dramatic long-run cut to Medicaid.
All right, so this is the same guy that was saying Obamacare was a Trojan horse and that he wants single payer, and also said that the people that were pushing Obamacare were willing to lie to the American people in order to get it passed. This is Jonathan Gruber saying, yeah, this is not really an Obamacare repeal. And he's the one that helped write Obamacare. So when they were asked specifically, what do you mean? See, he had the option of, oh, wait, I probably shouldn't have said that. Let me walk it back a little bit. No, he doubles down. He says, well, typically what people think of when they think of Obamacare are the subsidies, the regulations on the medical industry, so on and so forth. And he says, yeah, this bill doesn't do anything to change any of that. And he says, I don't like the bill. The changes that it does make are bad, but it's still not an Obamacare repeal. So here we have the guy that's actually put together Obamacare the way we know it today. And even he's saying, yeah, it's not an Obamacare repeal. Think about that for a second. He's saying he opposes the bill, but it's still not a repeal. It's essentially, according to Gruber, just a Medicaid cut. Now, keep in mind, even though they are making a Medicaid cut that is delayed for 3 years, that's still a year longer than the House. So this is actually worse than the House version of the bill when it comes to Medicaid cuts. And here's the other thing about that. He also says that it really won't affect the deficit at all. Yeah, he's right. It won't affect the deficit at all. And part of the reason that it won't is because it doesn't change any of the regulations. It doesn't really change any of the spending, except for a little bit of Medicaid spending a few years out. So when you're looking at this, even the guy who is dramatically opposed to the bill, doesn't like it, but was for single-payer health care and wants us to be all under a single government-mandated health care system like the UK or Canada, even he's saying this bill pretty much doesn't change anything about Obamacare from a technical standpoint. It's essentially just a Medicaid cut, and even it wouldn't do anything to reduce our spending. Well, then why are we passing it in the first place? If it's not going to reduce spending and it doesn't really change anything in Obamacare, this is what I'm saying. This bill is like 90% Obamacare, maybe more. I think 90 is honestly lowballing it a little bit. But it's not an Obamacare repeal, which is what we were promised by the Republican House and Senate when they were running. And here's the other thing about that. Does anybody really believe that this Medicaid cut is going to happen? Anybody? Do you really believe that? Because think about this for a second. Put yourself in the mind of where we will be in 3 years. That's five Congresses from now. There will be five different Congresses between now and when that cut is scheduled to take place. Furthermore, when that happens, five Congresses from now, Trump's reelection will be hanging in the balance. Do you really think they're going to make a massive Medicaid cut, especially when Donald Trump was running on part of his campaign promises were to not cut Medicare or Medicaid, when they have a chance of losing the White House? Guys, they can't get anything done now, and you think they're going to be doing things when that they've got to worry about that? There's absolutely no way. And the thing is, Republicans do this all the time. They have planned hypothetical cuts that may happen somewhere in the future to try to say, well, this plan cuts spending. And then time comes to it and they never do it. I don't know exactly what the rate is on that, but I'm telling you, their rate of actually making cuts when the cuts come up and are scheduled, it's practically non-existent, especially when those cuts are scheduled to take place after you have completely new people in the Congress. And keep in mind, if history is any teacher, Democrats will be making significant gains between now and then, because usually when you elect a president, the opposite party tends to have a little more success. We don't know that that'll happen, but it's likely. Why don't we do things that make sense for Republicans when we have the Republican White House, Senate, and the House of Representatives? We seriously can't get anything done with all three of those? The Republicans are worthless. I don't have anything else to say on it. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to call in, let me know what's on your mind, and there are people already waiting to do that right now. If you want to grab a line, 860-1440 would be the way to do that. For right now, we're going to go to Mark on line one. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, good morning, Caleb. How you doing?
Doing pretty good.
Good. If I could just segue into what you were saying earlier, I mean, I agree totally 100% with you. The Republican Party is totally 100% worthless. Why do I say that? Because the thing about it, they want single-payer health care system. These politicians, Mitch McConnell, they know any bill that they pass, any kind of health care replacement bill they pass, they know that one day The Republicans are not going to control the House. They won't control the Senate. And when the Democrats control it all, they're going to grow it. They're going to expand it. They're going to allocate more funds for it. They're going to raise taxes. And whatever bill they pass is going to be another massive, huge monstrosity of an entitlement. And, you know, that's why you have to repeal the whole thing. But Mitch McConnell is trying to ram through just anything to claim a victory, and he knows that it's going to turn into a single payer one day. And what he's going to do, he's going to throw his hands up and say, well, we have no other alternative. We can come together in bipartisan fashion, and we can craft up a bill that's beneficial for all Americans. Boom, there you got it. Single payer system.
Oh, and we're headed in that direction, and that's because progressivism is a cancer that grows in both parties. Keep in mind, the first progressive president was Republican Teddy Roosevelt. So this is something that has cropped up in both parties. There, it has its roots in Marxism, and they're moving towards power and control. And there is nothing you, with the exception of maybe food, there is no industry that you can take over that would give you more power and control than the medical industry.
Absolutely. And, you know, with the exception of the four or five actual conservative Republicans we have in the Senate, you know, I would have to say this. The Republican Party is way more nefarious and diabolical than the Democrat Party. Why do I say that? Because, see, they go back to their districts in the midterms, and they sound like Ronald Reagan in their districts, conservatives. You know, but with the Democrats, you know exactly what you're getting with them. They don't try to hide it. They're out in front with it. They tell you what they're going to do. And guess what? They unify, and they go 100% in unity towards what they want, a socialistic goal. Republicans don't do that.
And there's one other thing about the Democrats that you've yet to bring up. When it comes to the Democrats, you know, love them or hate them, despise their policies as much as I do, at least they fight for what they believe in.
Exactly.
You know, they say, we want single-payer health care, we want more government control of this or that,
yeah.
And then they actually vote that way.
They all unified behind Barack Obama 100%. There was no moderate Democrats. Look at what our Republican House, our Republican Senate is doing now. You wouldn't even know that Donald Trump was even president if the only people you listened to was Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell.
You probably wouldn't, and that's the thing. Thank you so much for your call, Mark. I appreciate it. When it comes to the Republicans and the way they react to things, it's almost as though Republicans, they hold seats. Democrats hold power. Because even when, like I said, we've got a Republican House, a Republican Senate, a Republican in the White House, we still can't freaking get anything done. Back when we just took the House after 2 years after Barack Obama was elected, the excuse was, well, we can't really do anything without the Senate. We've got one half of one branch of government. Okay, we delivered the Senate to them a few years later. Well, the president can veto anything that we pass. We really can't do anything unless we have a Republican White House. We deliver the White House to them. Every bill that they're proposing is a, you know, Rand Paul said that this is Obamacare light. I don't even know that you can call it Obamacare light. That would be like if light mayonnaise had 90% of the fat of mayonnaise. Well, what would be the purpose of having that? So I don't even think it quite qualifies as Obamacare light. This thing is still mostly Obamacare. Even the, like we talked about, even Jonathan Gruber, the architect of Obamacare, said that this thing is pretty much not an Obamacare repeal. It cuts some Medicaid, but it really doesn't do anything to Obamacare itself. So, I mean, you're exactly right, Mark. Thank you for your call. It just seems like no matter what the Republicans do, it's never in a conservative movement. They claim to be conservatives. They claim to be small government. They claim to care about free market capitalism and the rights of the individuals. And then they go up there and they vote exactly the opposite way most of the time. You know, the Republican Party, pretty good on gun rights most of the time, usually votes against measures that would increase abortion. Other than that, pretty much every other stance they take is to grow government. That's their basic instinct. And I think based on these moves, there is no other way to interpret what they are doing other than they do want a single payer healthcare system. I don't see how you could interpret that any different way. So here's the problem that we're running into with that, though. And we've been talking a lot about the Republican side of this. I do think that it's important that we talk about how we speak to the Democrats, because honestly, the Democrats in Congress, I don't know that we can do anything to change their minds. But when it comes to conversing with our friends and neighbors, and this is part of the purpose of the show Tactics, this is why we're here, I do think that we could be a little bit more strategic in our conversation with people on the left that have those sensibilities. I think we need to start talking about healthcare and many other issues in a different way. And here's what I mean by that. I was watching this clip from The View yesterday, and of course, Jedediah Bila being the only conservative on there, it perfectly highlighted something. And this is a common thing when we're talking about debates between people that are liberal and conservative. Conservatives deal with facts. Liberals deal with feelings. Because we had Whoopi and Joy Behar, and I honestly don't know the names of the other two ladies they had on that panel. But they were all talking back and forth against the new health care reform bill because they like Obamacare and like the measures that put in there. Weren't really talking so much about the actual nuts and bolts. They were talking about poor people that get sick and how we're a rich country and need to take care of people. Maybe they're right. I don't think that they are, but maybe they're right. But even if they were, that doesn't mean that Obamacare is the way to do that. And so when they were all talking about that, then Jedediah Bila, the only conservative on the panel, comes back and says, yeah, but look at how much this has hurt other people. The numbers don't add up. And so it's almost like we're talking two completely different languages when we're talking to someone on the left, because they're not really all that concerned about the facts and figures. They're not too concerned with a lot of the raw whether or not the policy even works or not. To them, this is about justice, about helping poor people, helping sick people, trying to make people feel better.
You know, I've been silent this morning.
Right.
I get it that you don't like the Republicans, but no, seriously, though, I've been listening so intently on every point you've made and callers have made. It all comes down to one thing. The government should just not be in the healthcare business.
It doesn't work.
Well, you see why it doesn't work. There's no meeting of the minds, really.
Yeah, and that's true. I tell you what, let's go to the phones. Let's go to John from Millbrook on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, as far as the parties are concerned, and y'all have been cutting both sides down quite a bit, and I wanted to get your insight on this.
Okay.
This is a Republican issue from the word go, an issue with which almost all Republicans are in favor of, and that most are being pro-life. If you were to take a vote just of the Republicans to completely do away with abortions in the country, do you think they'd really pull the string and do that? Or do they really not even have any guts on that? Do they just say things that they think wants to be, that will, of course, pander to their constituents like we are? Or would they really do what they said they were going to do? They certainly haven't done it on health care.
Well, that's a fantastic question, and here's the thing. Normally, we would have to deal with a hypothetical, and what you just presented was a hypothetical situation. However, we have some practical application that comes from this very healthcare bill. Planned Parenthood is the largest provider of abortion in the entire country. 42% of their annual budget comes directly from the federal government. They get about $5 million a year from the federal government, your taxpayer money. This bill defunds Planned Parenthood for exactly 1 year. That's it. So if you're asking whether or not the Republicans really care about abortion, I think that pretty much proves that the vast majority of them don't.
Well, they know that it's not an issue that's going to come before them anyway.
Right.
They know that that's been decided by the court, but they can take that stance, and then they're popular in their states where they come from. But in reality, if it came down to it, I don't think they do. And that part of that is what you just stated, that sort of proves it. But if it came down to a vote, just yes or no, I think they dropped the ball on that too.
Is it not amazing?
Is
it not amazing how Republicans seem to find a way to claim that their hands are tied regardless of what situation they're in?
That's true. And Democrats are great at being a victim on everything that ever come up at every time.
Well, that's true as
finding
well.
Finding enough victims too. So,
so that's that is a difference in tactics, you could say. And thank you for your call. I appreciate that a great deal. But no, you're 100% right. The Republicans seem to be experts at finding ways to claim that they have absolutely no power, even when they hold both houses of Congress and the presidency. And on top of that, let's look at the abortion thing for just one second. Even if the court has ruled, that abortion is the law of the land, you can't deny a person an abortion, you know, I would take issue with that anyway, because I think we need to do a better job of fighting in the courts. But even if that's the case, the Senate still has a recourse to that. It's called a constitutional amendment. When was the last time you heard a Republican proposing a constitutional amendment? They get a constitutional amendment through, doesn't matter what the court says. They could rule on the amendment later, maybe, but if you get an amendment that bans abortion in the country, well, then that's what the Constitution says from then on. But they're not even going to try that. So you're right. If we look at the practicality, no matter how much power the Republicans seem to have, they always claim that their hands are tied, which is one of the reasons that the theme of the show this morning has largely been the Republicans are worthless. 860-1440, your call is coming up next.
I look at the night, and it don't seem so lonely. We fill it up with only.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back, everybody. 860-1440 are the numbers. You are listening to Tactics. Caleb Colquitt here, back for News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. We have been talking a great deal about the healthcare debate, which I think it merits all the discussion that we've given it this week. It just simply is that important. So I was talking earlier about the way that we're talking about this issue. We've spent the vast majority of the morning talking about the Republicans and what they're doing, but speaking to the broader issue of healthcare itself, whether or not healthcare should be considered a right, whether or not the government should be involved in healthcare, I think to convince people that have that left-leaning sensibility, we do have to adjust our tone, the way that we talk about these issues, and here's what I mean by that. The right deals with facts, numbers, does it work, does it not work? That's the question that conservatives want answered when looking at a new policy. To be honest, and I'm not making fun of them, it's just the way that it seems to be, Democrats don't really care so much whether the policy works. And I'm not, again, trying to say that to be funny or to make a jab. They're more concerned with whether or not there are people being hurt and whether or not the bill makes them feel good. So we have to talk to them in the language that they understand. And again, not doing this to be demeaning, I think that it's a wonderful thing that liberals are so concerned with helping people. They're concerned with the poor. They're concerned with the sick. I think that their methodology goes about it the wrong way. But I certainly do believe earnestly that it comes from a good place. It comes from good intention. And I don't know that there's a whole lot you could do to change a hardcore leftist. I don't know that you could change someone who's a rabid socialist, somebody that's actually in Congress, in the Senate, in the DLC, that's a Democrat. But guys, we can talk to our friends and neighbors that happen to have left-leaning ideas and discuss these issues with them and have a conversation with them. And that's really the purpose of this whole show. So I want to talk to you for just a moment about the way to do that. So we have to be able to appeal to both sides. And letting liberals know that the reason we support the policies we do are because we care about people. Because there's a lot of really good conservatives that they're concerned about the numbers, they're concerned whether the program really works, but their motivation comes from what's right for regular people too. You remember that conversation I had with a caller yesterday, a guy named John? When we were talking about the minimum wage, he was saying, essentially, that I'm not concerned with middle-class people that have been at a company for 10 years and haven't seen a raise or haven't gotten a promotion. My whole point of those entire couple segments was that, yeah, but the minimum wage hurts those people. That was the whole thrust of what I was saying. maybe I didn't communicate it in the way that I should have or in a way that other people could understand it clearly. And maybe that's something that I need to work on myself. But the point is, our policies can reach people that believe the way the left believes and do want to help people. But we've got to make sure to include those and include them on the forefront if we're going to be able to change hearts and minds. For example, when it comes to Obamacare and the health insurance industry, the average health insurance premium has gone up 140% since the passage of Obamacare. Now, not all of that is due to Obamacare because premiums go up virtually every year, but they don't go up 140% in the span of 7 years. That's not a common occurrence. This is clearly because of the regulations and the massive shifts that happened in the healthcare industry. It's an unprecedented rise in premiums. And so because of that, there are middle-class families out there, not rich people, not six-figure salary families, just people trying to make sure that they don't default on their mortgage and have enough food to feed their kids and make sure their kids get a good education and that they can provide for their families and hopefully provide for a better future for them. Because keep in mind, that's about $3,000 less every year for the average family that goes to a family's gas, their clothes, their food, their other necessities, and now they're having to choose between paying for their health insurance premium, which, by the way, under Obamacare, is illegal for them not to have, and putting gas in their tank, and or maybe taking that extra family vacation, and you only have so many of those when your kids are little. That's the appeal that we need to be making. That's the way we need to be able to talk to people on the left, because if we can do that, maybe they'll see a little bit more where we're coming from and why we're taking the stances that we do. And here's another thing. Those large insurance companies, they're the ones that helped write Obamacare. They got rich off of this. Now, the small insurance companies, the mom-and-pop places, which you don't have as many of those in insurance, obviously. You have larger providers. But, you know, what about the insurance companies that went completely out of business in certain states and had to drop all their employees, and now those people are out of work? Obamacare hurt average people. And once we make that case, and also make the case that there were a lot of big insurance companies that helped write that bill that profited off of the government showing favoritism to them because they were on the ground floor of this bill being written, maybe they'll be a little more open to some of the criticisms and some of the thoughts we have. Let's go to a new caller, Mike, on line one.
Hey, man, how you doing?
Doing all right. What's on your mind, Mike?
Thanks for taking my call. And all right, so down in Gulf Shores, Alabama, we've got a problem with major government overreach and a friend of mine who runs a beach service.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the city comes out and they have this idea that nobody can leave anything on the beach. That's fine. Sounds good.
Right.
But all the beach services down here, excuse me, been wanting to reach out to somebody and try to get the pot stirred. All right. All the beach services down here, ones that have been around a while, well, they gave them a five-year notice. They said, you've got 5 years, and then get your beach loungers off of the beach. Well, that's all well and good, but what about everybody else? There's a lot of other small businesses around here that I'm well acquainted with, good friends with.
Right.
And now these guys aren't subject to the same rules as everybody else. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And what I don't understand.
All right, you got about 30 seconds, Mike, because I'm coming up against a break.
Hey, I just wanted to bring it up.
Okay.
It's a problem. It's a problem.
Sounds
if anybody
like
else is out there, you know. I mean, they don't make everybody accountable to the same rules.
And that's a real problem. Thank you for your call, Mike. I wish I had more time to talk to you about this issue, but I'm up against a hard break. But yeah, and the healthcare bill is part of that, and the smaller example that Mike just gave is a part of it. Large businesses typically like government intervention because they can absorb a little bit more of the cost, and it hurts their competition. Mike's 100% right on that. Hour two coming up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
A prominent American tech company in the crosshairs of the European Union. We have the details on tactics. Welcome back, everybody. Hour two of Tactics is on now. As always, I'm Caleb Colquitt here with News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app for those of you who are listening out of town or, you know, just like listening to us on the app. We're here regardless of what way you're listening to us. We're glad that you're here either way. So, Google the other day, it was announced that they're going to be hit with the largest fine in the history of the European Union. So, the European Union has a what's known as an antitrust law, which essentially is intended to, at least the stated intent, and I'm going to explain why that may or may not be the case here. The intent is similar to a anti-monopoly law. So what they're trying to do is keep one company from dominating the entirety of an industry. And because of that, they're saying that they have to fine Google for something that they've done. It's a $2.7 billion fine. So this is unprecedented, never had one this big. In fact, if I'm remembering the report correctly from CNN, it's actually twice as large as the second highest fine. So this is a massive, massive fine for Google to pay. Now, Google brings in about $90 billion a year. But think about this. So people are saying, yeah, they can afford it. They take in $90 billion a year. Well, maybe, but A, whether or not they can afford it or not should not be factored into whether or not they should be hit with a fine. I mean, you wouldn't want a police officer to pull you over and say, ah, you can afford a speeding ticket. Was I speeding, officer? Ah, that's not really important. You can afford it. That's not how the law works. So keep in mind also that $90 billion means that two of that, that's, you know, roughly about 3% of their annual income, a little less than 3%. So that's still a pretty big cut into their profit margin. $2.7 billion, that's a lot. So why did this happen and what's the rationale for fining them? According to the EU, their reason is that they are unfairly favoring their own digital services over their rivals. To explain what they mean by that, Google, as everyone knows, the biggest search engine in the world. People go to that. I mean, for goodness sake, Google has become a verb. When people ask you a question, you say, hey, Google it. It's not even put it through a search engine. It's just, hey, Google it. It's become almost like Harley Davidson or Jacuzzi. The brand name is so popular, people think that it actually is almost synonymous with what it actually does. And so when we're talking about Google, massive, massive tech company, very, very successful. And because of that, and because they are the dominant search engine in Europe as well, not just in America, but the world over, the EU is upset at them for giving a boost to their own digital services over their competition. And Google owns a lot of smaller companies, which it can highlight in certain search results. For example, if you search for something on Google, you're probably more likely to get something from YouTube because Google owns YouTube. If you're searching for information on phones, you may get something about Android phones first because Google also owns Android. There's just a couple of examples. But when it comes to other products, they're saying they offer the other products. If you search for something on Google, you're going to get stuff about iPhones as well. But what they're saying is Google can't highlight certain businesses that they own over their competition. Actually, they can. It's called vertical integration, and it's a perfectly legitimate business practice. Let's say, for example, just to explain what vertical integration is, you essentially buy out portions that you need for your business to run, and advertising can be considered a part of that. This is something that was popular in the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, so the early 1900s. They would have certain business owners, they would own, for example, a construction company and they would also own a steel mill. Well, you're paying less for the steel if it's your own company. You can give yourself a deal on that if you own both. Google does exactly the same thing. They own YouTube. They want YouTube to be successful so they can give a little nudge to YouTube in their search results, and that's perfectly all right. If and this is something that I've been saying for a long time. As far as vertical integration goes, I don't know why Alexander Shinara has not purchased a billboard company. That tends to make sense to me that since he spent so much money on that, he should just buy a billboard company. But and that would help him out greatly. But anyway, back to this. It's a perfectly legitimate business strategy. Let's say, for example, I own a cattle ranch and I own a steakhouse. Well, that does not mean I have to buy steaks from other cattle ranches just because it would be fair competition. I'm a private business. I can do what I want. And if I'm going to get a better deal using my own cattle that I produce myself so I don't have to pay for them to sell it in my own steakhouse, why wouldn't I do that? There's absolutely nothing wrong with using multiple businesses that you own to your advantage. Now, granted, there are some people that emphasize that they use their competition and talk about how they try to create a fair space, and that's part of their advertising marketing, and they do that to get more business, and that's perfectly okay. Even though I don't care for this company much, Progressive does that. Their big thing is we advertise that you can go to us for one-stop shopping, you can compare prices to us and everybody else. We see that with Trivago, for example. Now, unlike Progressive, Trivago is not one of the companies that's in the running to get your business, so it's a little different in that sense. But Trivago is just a search engine for hotel rooms. You get to compare all the hotel rooms, all the rates here in one spot from all the different sites like, you know, Priceline and Hotspot and all those. So vertical integration is a perfectly legitimate business practice because those other companies that I just mentioned, Trivago and Progressive, they do talk about other companies, but they do that in the hopes of getting more business. And they do it voluntarily. No one told them that they have to do that. With Google, their private industry, they could show you just results from their own companies if they wanted to. They don't, because they know that they're a search engine and people want to be able to see other options. But there's absolutely nothing wrong with them giving a boost to their own businesses and their own digital services if they want to. Now, granted, Google is denying these claims, denying that they even do that, but my point is, whether or not they did it or not, in Europe, I know for a fact they do it in America. And in fact, you can actually purchase. You can go there and buy. I don't know exactly how it works because I've not done this. I'm not a major internet company. But you can buy things from Google to try to boost your search engine results, if I'm not mistaken. I think they actually have a Google ad service for that. But my point in all that is, as far as business goes, it's a 100% legitimate business practice to promote your own businesses through other businesses that you own, to use other businesses that are your private property to emphasize other businesses. For example, Cumulus, sometimes we run promos for our own stuff. And I'm not even talking about our own shows, although we could talk about that, but we'll run ads if we're looking for work or whatever. We'll say, hey, you know, check us out at Cumulus.com. Well, yeah, we own the radio company. That's all right. We don't pay ourselves for that. We're promoting our business through other avenues that we own. And that's perfectly legitimate. So I think this is the EU just trying to, I don't know, puff its chest out and find Google an exorbitant amount of money just simply because they can. 860-1440 are the numbers. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. Now, with everything that's happening with Google, it's important to understand that part of the reason I'm bringing this to your attention is because the EU tends to move in such a way that the UN and in some cases, America follows shortly thereafter, maybe a decade or so. And the EU seems to not understand that Google is not a public service or a charity organization. Now, if Google were the government, for example, and they're favoring some companies over others, yeah, that's 100% a problem. But just because Google happens to own a useful service does not make them part of the public works. They're not, you know, the utilities, for example. And so they got into business specifically to make money. They're not doing it for charity. They're not doing it to help people find things. Obviously, good companies do care about their product and want people to think about their product when they're looking for something. I believe Google's reached that. Like I said, people even use Google as a verb now. They've become so connected to what people think about when you use a search engine. But my point in all of that is Google got into this to make money. And that's perfectly okay. It seems that the EU doesn't like the fact that they're in it to make money. They would rather them be a public service. They would rather them do this just for charity and be impartial when it came to their search engine results, not necessarily be concerned with making money over it. But that's not how businesses work. So the EU just seems to not understand that. The EU official even said that their top, as their top search engine, talking about Google there, they had a responsibility to take extra measures not to promote their digital services over their rivals. Why? I don't get why they have that responsibility. Furthermore, this statement is essentially her admitting that they're targeting Google with special rules because they're doing well. She's saying that you have to take extra measures because you're on top. Because you are doing better than your competition, you have to take special measures that nobody else has to take. You have to take extra precautions to not push your digital services over everybody else's. This is a anti-free market, anti-capitalism mentality, which a lot of people in the EU unfortunately have. That if you're doing well, you need to do less well. You're doing too well, you're pushing out the competition, so you need to take extra measures to make sure you're not making more money on the side based on your success.
But they're doing what Google or anybody else, when they do well and they really succeed, the consumer, the person using the product, does better too because they have a better product to use.
Absolutely.
And if you put any type of restrictions or regulations that are unfair, it's just going to hurt everybody if they have to cut here and cut there to come up and meet the regulations that are imposed upon them fairly or unfairly. They can regulate themselves, can't they?
They can to a great degree, and good businesses will do that because it's good business practice. But let's look at this from a standpoint, and I wanted to do this. We can bring in a little bit of the minimum wage conversation we were having the other day. When it comes to businesses being regulated for doing quote-unquote too well or making enough money, which is not the government's place to decide in the first place, here's the issue that you constantly run into. Good businesses make other people rich. That's how free markets work. Google is a really good example of that. There are people that literally make their living off of YouTube. This is an actual thing. You see the ads on Google. You don't even have to find an advertiser, which, you know, as somebody who has to find people to sponsor me, that would be a dream come true, that I just have to click a button. They find my advertisers for me, their sponsors for me. And then Google, because they own YouTube, pays people for producing good videos that get a lot of views. And you get paid by the view. So it's a merit-based system. There are people that literally don't do any work. I mean, not to say that that isn't work, because it's hard to produce good content. I should know. But when it comes to YouTube, there are people that literally make their livings off of just making YouTube videos that people like, and that's perfectly all right. Google, because of their good business practices, make other people rich. Android. There are a lot of third-party companies and phone manufacturers that have gotten rich off of using the Android system because anybody can use it. Now, they have to get permission from Google first, and they have to pay for it. But their phones make money, and people within their company make more money, average working-class families, because Google has good business practices. just to use an example, Google is not really all that unique in that sense. To make money in this country, you have to make other people rich. That's the way that it works. You have to improve the lives of other people, and that's what that's what's so great about the free market. When we were looking at, let's just take a company that's been out there for a long time, Henry Ford.
You read my mind. I read yours. What I was going to say.
You were going to say Henry Ford?
Yeah, that's a good example.
Right. Well, what happened with Henry Ford is that he had the idea for the assembly line. So standard,
mass production.
Right. Standardized moving parts, which that assembly line idea was used by people that had nothing to do with cars. And his ideas, people copying his business model, made other people rich as well. Let's look at the standardized part and what that did. Not only did it make cars available to the masses so it improved their lives because they could buy a cheap product that was reserved for the rich beforehand, but then they could also go out and that started local dealerships. People that Henry Ford wasn't making money off those people, but he had to have a dealership because he had to figure out a way to get his product out there.
Everybody wanted a Ford.
Right, exactly.
And they could get it at any color, as long as it was black.
Right. As many options back then as now.
But it is. Now, that is impressive that it led to so many local dealerships across the country. Everybody, automatically, they were going to do a good business because people knew about Ford.
And eventually, that business model helped make other companies rich as well. Dick Brubaker doesn't sell Fords over at Brubaker Motors. He sells Kias and Chryslers and Dodges and Jeeps. But they followed the business model that erupted out of Henry Ford's good idea. They're using those same ideas, even though Henry Ford's not making money off of them. I mean, Henry Ford's not making money off of anybody now because he's dead. But the Ford Motor Company, the company that he started, they're not making money off that. But they followed that good business model because they saw what worked, and it made it better. And let's not even just look at dealerships and the cars themselves. Advanced Auto Parts, AutoZone, all those companies that make standardized parts that now fit those cars, they got rich and they made money because they started businesses providing a service they needed. Let's look at auto mechanics, like our good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center, of course. They made money because there were now standardized cars that they could work on. And so literally a whole industry cropped up because one guy had a good idea. Now, maybe somebody else would have come along and figured that out after Henry Ford. I tend to think that they probably would have. But the point in all that is there is this mentality that the EU is pushing forward that, unfortunately, a lot of people in our modern world have, that companies shouldn't do too well. But companies doing well makes other people rich. It's not just wealthy CEOs at the top. There's a lot of working class people that have jobs created for them because a company does really well, and they reinvest in new innovations, and they reinvest in new technology, and reinvest in workers.
And the consumer does well.
Absolutely.
Better.
How much better is your life now that you have a smartphone with literally the collective knowledge of the entire human race at your fingertip, which you can get to at any time?
I never would have dreamed that it was possible, but now that it's possible and I've got one, there's really no price on possessing one, so to speak.
Right. It's like being in Star Trek. You have a computer in the palm of your hand.
You can just absolutely control your entire life. If you have the right app, you control what's going on in your house. You can
right. And the vast majority of those apps are free. You got to pay for some of them.
Well, you have ads with them, but
And some of the free ones have ads.
That's okay with me. I understand nothing's free.
But then other companies may be getting businesses because of those ads. So even then, you have more people making money. And so, you know, capitalism and free markets, they're not perfect. It's not that they never have corruption or anything like that. I'm not making that case. But there is this mentality that protrudes the EU and a lot of other those global organizations that regulate businesses, that businesses shouldn't do well, but businesses doing well helps regular people too. And that's one thing that they seem to not understand. Also, the EU has said that the company has to propose their own measures to fix the violation. So in other words, they're saying, Google, you're doing something wrong. We're not sure exactly how, but you have to present us with the fix, and then we have to approve it, which is madness on an unthinkable level. But, you know, they've gone after a lot of American internet companies with very hefty fines. Just the other year, they said that Apple's got to pay $14.5 billion in Ireland on back taxes. There are several cases where they had smaller fines with Facebook and Twitter. And so they've gone after a lot of these big American tech companies, I think in part, maybe not exclusively, but in part because the EU just would rather their own companies are doing well. Well, if you want your own European-based companies to do well, maybe you guys should get better at this. Maybe a little less socialism in your own countries would help with that. I don't know. But the bottom line is, this is all about control and redistribution of wealth. Because that's an insane policy to have, that you can't use your own business to promote your other businesses. That's ridiculous on an unprecedented scale, and especially to fine them this much for it. All right, 860-1440 are the numbers. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The general principles on which the fathers achieve independence were the general principles of Christianity. John Adams.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. Anybody out there want to win $4,000?
Yep.
Well, you can do that and spend it however you want to in our Red, White, and Win contest brought to you by American Oak and More.
Oh, I can.
Oh, yes, you can. No, well, you can because you're not eligible. You're a Cumulus employee.
But I could spend it.
Theoretically, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have trouble.
Yeah. So, this is brought to you by American Oak and More. You don't pay with fake money, so don't settle for fake wood. Celebrate Independence Day with $4,000 in your pocket. Enter for your chance to win at www.newsradio1440.com. It's what the founders would have wanted. So
you guess?
Yes, they would. I think that's actually in one of Madison's letters that go to newsradio1440.com and enter the Red, White, and Win contest.
Slightly ahead of his time.
A little bit. He's amazing foresight, that man. But anyway, did have a story I wanted to bring to your attention that I saw the other day. CNN, there was a little bit of a snafu, to say the least. This was I referred to one of my friends the other day. We were talking about this. I said it was a little bighorn level screw up with CNN, you know, General Custard and all that. So
I get it.
Yeah, so you know where this is. This
too
is going.
Soon. No,
too soon. Yeah. So CNN had three very credible journalists resign yesterday, and they had to issue a retraction because one of the stories that they put out there was completely false. Not an ounce of truth to it whatsoever, and they put it out there as though it's a serious news story. These were three very credible journalists. So one was a Pulitzer Prize winner. Another was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, so didn't win, but he was in the running. And another was an executive editor for CNN Investigates. So all three of these guys, very reputable, up until this moment, trustworthy journalists. Now they had to resign because the story that they put out there turns out that their source was not reliable and the information they got was bad information because it didn't happen. Now, here's the thing. This raises two very distinct possibilities. One is that these guys were always iffy on the facts, but they got awards anyway because the media loved them. So these awards, which are, you know, put up and voted on by other media people, they weren't really that great a journalist, but they kept getting these awards anyway because the journalists really don't care so much about the facts, and they got these awards just because of that. The other possibility is that these guys were very good journalists, but they cut corners because they wanted to get to the story first, and they wanted to nail Trump because this story connected Trump to Russia in some way, and CNN's been pushing that for a while now. Again, not ascribing motive, just saying that because these guys know that they didn't like Trump, they wanted the Russian collusion thing to be true, and because of that, they jumped the gun and ran with a story, even though they hadn't thoroughly vetted their information. I tend to think the second one is a little bit more likely. The first one is possible, but even if it's true, it's hard to prove. So I'm just going to go with we're going to operate off of the second option for the time being. Personally, I think CNN should have straight up fired them. I think they should have, when they turned in their resignation, say, yeah, you can't resign, you're fired. I think that would have sent a better message out to everybody.
I think that eliminating them, and because keep in mind these journalists did not uphold CNN's own standards as far as establishing credibility of their sources. So what this story actually said was it claimed that a Trump supporter, Anthony Scaramucci, I think is the way to say his name, he was under a Senate investigation, according to the story. But it turns out he's not under a Senate investigation. And this guy, just so you know, he was a transition team member. He was floated as a possible cabinet member, so very involved in the Trump campaign. They claimed that he met with an executive of a powerful Russian investment fund. Turns out, no, he didn't. And he certainly was not under Senate investigation for that because it didn't happen. So no truth to that whatsoever. I will say, though, I want to give props to Anthony Scaramucci for thanking CNN for correcting the error and moving on. After he saw that they had made that retraction, he said, he tweeted out, appreciate CNN doing the right thing, handled it classily, and now I'm going to move on. I think that was the right response because he had essentially been smeared by a news organization. A lot of people would have taken that personally, maybe held a grudge for a while. He just said, nope, they did the right thing. They corrected it. I'm moving on. So props to him for that. Here's one of the big issues, though. CNN is not helping its image because with the Trump voters and the Trump loyalists, they tend to see CNN as fake news anyway because Donald Trump on a regular basis calls them fake news. I don't think that that's the case. I think that CNN is still a very reputable news organization. Not only, and I'm not saying that this because they're our news partners here. I've always thought that about CNN. I think they're the closest thing to a balanced news source that we have. You know, MSNBC tends to lean very far left. Fox tends to lean slightly to the right. I wouldn't say all the way over to the right, but
I don't know where Fox is leaning anymore. See, that's the thing with CNN. They've got a chance to really make some really deep inroads here.
Oh, absolutely. And with the way that Fox has had to change its primetime lineup, CNN is making some massive gains in the ratings on this. I think that since Trump has been in office, they've, frankly, especially with their daytime programming, not so much with their main anchors like Tapper and not Andrew Cuomo. He's the morning guy. He actually is pretty bad on the left. But the other guy, Anderson Cooper, you know, those guys are very reputable. But when it comes to especially their daytime programming, they've tended to be pretty biased, at least from my experience. And I watch them in the morning, so I'm going off of that. Obviously, don't watch them during this time slot. But when it comes to that, CNN is just not helping its image with the Trump people if they're wanting to establish themselves as a reputable news site. And I think that they are, by and large. This was a one-time thing, and I think that CNN probably learned their lesson and won't be so quick to jump the gun in the future. Here's the thing. They also promoted and talked about James Comey testifying that he did not say to President Donald Trump that he was not under investigation three times. When the testimony actually happened, Comey actually confirmed that. So this is the second time CNN has shown some anti-Trump bias and jumped the gun on a story when it turns out it wasn't true. So CNN, you know, you're not dead to me or anything like that, but let's tighten up the screws, make sure that your stories are accurate, and maybe not be so quick to jump the gun on some of these stories. Not everybody at CNN is unfairly against Trump. And in fact, both Anderson Cooper and Tapper have on multiple occasions stuck up for him. One of the things that soured the relationship between CNN and Trump was that fake dossier that came out that was trying to show that he had collusion with Russia. But the way that they reported on that, they reported it fairly, they reported it accurately. There was nothing in that particular report, even though it ticked Trump off, that was incorrect. Now, BuzzFeed totally put in the salacious stuff and didn't handle that story correctly, but CNN did. And so credit to them on that. I think that this is another example of the media being in a race to be wrong. There are a lot of people, I'm not ascribing this to the whole of CNN like I've made very clear, but there are several journalists that are in a race to be wrong when it comes to Donald Trump because they despise the man so much they want some of these stories to be true, and so they run with them before they have thoroughly vetted their sources. Usually that doesn't happen as much at reputable news sites like CNN. But it apparently does happen, and it's important for those in the media to take a step back, stay calm. I've been criticized by some other people in the media for being a little slow to take up stories on my own program. Part of the reason that I do that is I want to give it adequate time to really digest the story, get some of the information and the details on it, and then come forward to my audience with it, because I believe that's my responsibility, even though I'm not a journalist and don't have to be impartial.
That's what you did just recently with the ballpark shooting, where you said, I'm going to take 48 hours.
Right.
But basically let this marinate.
Exactly. And we covered it live when it was happening. And in fact,
I'm talking about your opinion on it.
Right, but my opinion on it, I waited 48 hours to really give me time to get some information out there and change it. So I get that CNN can't always do that, and I get that my standard is my standard, and it doesn't have to apply to everybody else. But maybe they should be a little more willing to take a step back, take a breath, and maybe if they don't break the news right away, but they're the only news company that waited long enough to get all the facts right, that might give them more credibility instead of less. I get that everybody's in a race to break the story first, but sometimes it's better to wait a little bit. Because breaking a story first when the story's not true like it was in this case, that doesn't help you. I will say this kind of as my final thought. CNN responded in the right way for the most part. But they do need to create an atmosphere where everybody under their roof knows that fairness and accuracy is expected every single time without exception. I think that they can do that, and I don't think that's an unfair standard to put on them. Chaplin's report next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Matthew 22:37-40. And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets."
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Couple things I did want to mention before we move into the chaplain's report. First of all, you got to go down and check out my friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. We mentioned them a little bit earlier in the show, but they've been in business here in Montgomery for 50 years, half a century. There's a reason for that. They know what they're doing. They're competent. They're quick. I'm usually in and out of there. Even if I need something major done, it's no more than an hour most of the time. And so they get you in, they get you out, they give you a fair price, and they do good work. I mean, you really can't ask for more than that out of a mechanic. So Jim Woodham, Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center, been in business for 50 years. They're out there on the Troy Highway. Anything that you need done, they can handle it. If not, they can refer you to somebody who can. And they never just go ahead and do things and then charge you for them later. If they find something, they happen to spot something that you need done, they come out, they talk to you, they explain the situation, they tell you how much it's going to cost, and then if you want to go forward, then they'll do it and take care of it for you, and they're going to do a great job, so you're going to want to go ahead and do that if you can. So that's Jim Woodham, Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center on the Troy Highway in South Montgomery. Go check them out today. Also, a little bit of news for the show itself. Tomorrow we have Matt Clark of the Foundation of Moral Law, who will be coming by to be with us, he said, at least for an hour. And you may have noticed that this whole week, even though there have been a slew of Supreme Court decisions coming down, that I haven't talked about any of them. Normally, I cover that stuff pretty quickly. There's a reason for that. We're going to have him on. He's an expert. He's an attorney with the Foundation for Moral Law. And so he's going to help us explain and sort through some of these things, give us the legal implications and what they really mean. So be sure to look out for that tomorrow if you're interested in what the Supreme Court is doing, which is of the utmost importance right now. A lot of good things coming out of the Supreme Court. He's going to be here to help explain that to us tomorrow. So don't miss that show. The Chaplain's Report. We've been going through the first chapter of John, where John sort of philosophically introduces the concept of Jesus Christ along with introducing the man Jesus Christ as he lived. So the Apostle John writes in John 1:9-13, "There was the true light the light being Jesus, of course, which he just explained. There was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believed in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. John is pointing out this dramatic irony that takes place in the narrative of the life of Jesus Christ, that Jesus, who made the world, which he points out in 10, the world was made through Jesus Christ, and yet when he came into the world in physical form, the world didn't recognize him. The world didn't know who he was. It's this amazing dichotomy of ideas, in a sense, that Jesus Christ, who is the creator of everything around us, who is the one who people, who God made through him, those same people couldn't figure out who he was. It's funny, in a sense, because even the apostles and the vast majority of his family didn't figure it out until later. He had been wandering around the world with the apostles about 2 years before they really had a firm understanding of who he was. And we see that really brought to fruition in Peter's confession to Christ. But you can tell by their behavior and some of the things that they say early on in the narrative of Christ's life that they didn't even really get it for a very long time and didn't fully get it until he was raised from the dead. Same thing with his family. With the exception of seemingly Mary, the other members of Christ's family, his brothers and sisters, they didn't think that Jesus was actually the Son of God. And so, we don't see a transition in them until after he was resurrected either. For example, his brother James, who was a very prominent figure in the early church, he didn't believe that Christ was who he said he was until after the resurrection. And so it's funny that John is pointing out that this world that he created, even those closest to him, didn't really get who Jesus Christ was until a little bit later. It took them a while to figure it out. The world rejected Christ and didn't recognize him, and that's why he was crucified. I've always wondered what Jesus thought about, knowing every single person intimately, knowing that he was the one that created them, and yet at the exact same time, knowing that they had no idea who he was. It would be such a strange sensation. That would be like roaming through a world where the person that knows you best, whether it's a family member or your best friend, you know everything about them, and they have no idea who you are. It's such a strange scenario to put yourself through, and that's how Jesus Christ was with every single person that he ever encountered. I'm not sure exactly what went through his mind when he would have some of these conversations with people, trying to help them understand who he was and his doctrine, and knowing them as well as anyone ever could, and them not even knowing his own name, not knowing who he really was. It's such a strange notion to think about. Also, it's important to note in this passage of Scripture that the Apostle John makes this distinction, that there are those who receive the light and those who refuse the light. Notice that that distinction is a choice. He's not saying there are some people that Christ liked and some people Christ didn't, and so the people he did like, he received them. He's saying they received Jesus. There's action required on our part. That for us to be ones that are in the light, to accept the enlightenment that Christ has to offer, we have to receive the light. He says those that did receive him, as many as believed on his name, those are the ones that became children of God. We have the right to become children of God through Jesus Christ. Why? Because he's the begotten one. You see, we're children by flesh and blood, but that's not how we became children of God. We become children of God through Jesus, becoming spiritual heirs. There's a difference between being created and being begotten. God didn't create Jesus. He was a begotten son. We're created. We're like statues, not like children. But through Christ, through the actual begotten Son, we get to become children in the same way that Jesus is a child of God. We become spiritually children through his blood. Stay the course, friends.